This is Fuel.
Fuel for thought.
Fuel injected.
Fuel for your business.
Jet fuel.
Welcome to Fuel, the new business podcast for the UK business development community, brought to you in association with The Advertist, business development tools and insight for creative marketing and communications agencies. And I'm your host, a Smith called Keith. Now, I'd have an ocean if I had a drop of water every time a marketing, PR or digital agency owner told me that their main source of new business was referrals. It's understandable. It takes less effort and you don't have to do the really hard thing of trying to sell to people that you don't know. But if you don't have an alternative strategy for generating new prospects outside your bubble, how's your agency going to grow? How are you going to innovate or inspire your team with new, rich and varied projects? Using The Advertist to support existing referral business allows you to monitor and act upon new opportunities that challenge your agency. Using The Advertist to support existing referral business allows you to monitor and act upon new opportunities that challenge your agency. The Advertist is packed full of news, insight, facts, figures, people moves, tenders, lists and mergers, acquisitions, crowdfunding and venture capital updates to give you options so you're not scrambling to generate new business from scratch when something catastrophic happens like, a pandemic strikes. There's no better way to power your new business. The Advertist gets you to the door, all you have to do is push through it. Visit The Advertist at www.theadvertist.com, that's theadvertist.com, for a free trial or call the team on 0203 356 3717 today. This week, we're going to take a deep dive down a rabbit hole to get a 10,000 foot view of the 600 pound gorilla in the room, of the value of data to the new business process. But before we do, Jeremy Davis has just called house with his bullshit bingo card because he's looking at the new developments in sales and marketing jargon.
As an occasional stand-up comic and, more importantly, a new business guy, I know that good timing is a virtue, so I've had cause to celebrate twice this week. First, I wrote a gag for another podcast about the manager of a famous football team and a certain catchphrase from The Apprentice, and he got fired the day after it went out. And then came the news that the UK government's world-beating test and trace coronavirus service was using Excel spreadsheets, which I spoke about at length on this very podcast earlier in the year. Okay, so that one is more of a callback than great comic timing, but I'm so comedically rusty after an enforced six-month break that I'll celebrate the small wins. One aspect of the working-from-home trend, okay, so it's not really a trend, which is something that builds organically and gradually, as much as something that just happened, like taxes. Events, dear boy, events. But one of the less remarked aspects of the working from home thing is the long-term impact on office jargon. Does anyone use jargon on a Zoom call? I doubt it. In my experience of virtual meetings, the old icebreakers like, let's do a deep dive, or let's have a quick round table, have been replaced by new workplace buzz phrases like, is this thing on? You need to unmute yourself, or sorry, the dog's just been sick. Can I call you back in 5 minutes? Jargon is one of the relatively few fields of business BS where sales and new business can be said to lead the way, mainly because we all cottoned on to the need to sound authentic and talk in plain English. Other languages are available, although personally, having spent years learning Latin, I've never found it very useful as a prospecting tool, ages before everyone else. Notwithstanding the cringeness of the names agencies give their creative processes, phrases like blue sky thinking and thinking outside the box were cancelled by salespeople long before account managers stopped using them in meetings. And as for other more respectable professions, have you ever tried reading legalese? It makes Latin look cool. Jargon busting has become a much sought-after skill in business and in marketing especially. Jargon busters are here to save business in much the same way that Ghostbusters were here to save the world. Except that all seems to have happened is that a new lexicon of jargon has emerged, just as a new scarier bunch of spooks turned up in time for Ghostbusters 2. And I must say that I'm worried that, just as with that film, the sequel will turn out to be much less successful. The one that's currently doing my head in is, I'm concerned about the optics of this. Why not just say, this looks bad? It's currently only used figuratively, but it can't be long before brand managers start complaining about the optics of their packaging on shelf. And the day that happens, I will, with delicious irony, stop listening.
Right. So if I'm a new business now, or marketing, or if I'm one of your regular listeners, I would be looking at the data and saying, does this data validate the sectors I want to target, where I think I can win? You know, am I able to convert that data into something that I can go to my CEO or my chairman and go, this sector is where I want to pitch and play, and these are the reasons why, and it's growing, and the business numbers are growing, turnover's increasing, costs are decreasing, whatever the measures are you want to look at. You know, that for me is where the data turns into something, from something dry into something super desirable.
Well, I think we'll leave it there. We'll just put your phone number on the bottom. That's it.
Have you ever wished that you could add rich financial data to your research when you're investigating new sectors to approach? Without an accurate understanding of the big picture that any sector faces, you're going to miss some potentially huge opportunities to build bridges with new prospects. Being useful is a big part of the business development toolkit, and creating relationships with new business prospects by showing that you understand their market and providing them with facts and figures to make their job easier is half the battle. Instead of selling you, sell them. Sell your understanding of them. Show you've identified areas for development, and suddenly you're talking their language, not your language. My guest this week is at the forefront of the fintech revolution, and her company has a broad range of services that are going to help agencies include financial data in proposals that show understanding of the now and provide solutions for the future. Now, you no longer have to rely on historical data that could be months or even years out of date. Now you have access to real-time data that's curated using predictive AI and machine learning. So if you think data is for nerds, think again. It's now a huge part of the new business process, and we're now going to make it available to you. Welcome to the world of real-time industry intelligence for new business. Now, if you get excited by the role that good data plays in the world of new business, then my guest this week is going to rock your world. With these new remote conditions we're all working under, new business development has been thrust into the spotlight. Identifying new prospects, building transactional relationships with them that grow into valuable business deals for your agency, and then generally nurturing that pipeline comes down to a simple approach: being useful. Standing out from the crowd with prospects these days means being smart and sharing information that helps make the buyer's job easier. As Hank Blank pointed out on the show recently, this is exactly how the big multinationals grew. It's from their playbook, and it's a proven gateway into clients. Clients want leadership, and they want you to be relevant. And a great way to do this is by providing them with information about their business that shows you understand their position. And that's called empathy. The form that this information takes can be wide and varied, from sharing amusing anecdotes and observations on email and social media, to providing your prospect with hard currency information that helps them justify using your agency that they wouldn't be able to get from anyone else. And you're about to enter a world of intelligent data. My guest runs a fintech business that levels the playing field for SMEs by providing them with predictive forecasts on sectors, finance, and corporations, curated from machine learning and artificial intelligence. So move over Excel spreadsheets, there's a new game in town, and if your agency feeds off agility and thought leadership and analysis, then we've got a nutritious, healthy, and delicious feast for you. Welcome, Zita McMillan of Predictive Black.
Thank you very much, Pete. I'm going to record that intro for myself and just press play whenever I want someone to say about us.
Well, it's it's good of you to come on the show anyway and to help us out. And you are more than Predictive Black, and I'm sorry for linking your identity like that. But I'm sure you've got a great life outside of the business too. But
not right now.
thanks for being on the show. You're working from home. Is everybody working from home these days?
Everybody's working from home. Actually, we set out to be remote by design, because if you work with developers or any tech people, they're not social creatures. They don't like offices, and they don't like getting out of their pajamas, and they don't like working regular hours. So we put a virtue around it by saying we're remote by design. So actually when coronavirus hit, we were all set.
Fantastic. Well, we'll come on to that in a little bit more detail, because that's it's a fascinating side of that business I want to cover with you. And I don't mean to kind of oversell your business, but I am a real fan of kind of adding value when nurturing sort of client relationships. And I think that Predictive Black can really help our audience. So just stick with this, folks, because it's going to change the way you do business, and it's going to show you how you can use financial data to gain a competitive edge. Now, first of all, it's important to establish your bona fides. Not only are you proficient in the language of finance, but you've also got a background in the world of advertising and marketing, haven't you? So could you tell us a bit more about the career path that brought you here?
So I think my career peaked when I was in my early 20s, actually. So I did all my exciting stuff at the start. So I started out...
Like Orson Welles, you lived it backwards.
I've just gone backwards, yeah. I'm like literally Benjamin Button. And so I started out in advertising and moved to London, was at JWT in Manchester for a bit. That was great fun. Moved to London, worked for publicists and did lots and lots of fantastic things. Went to go on great shoots. And then, as all of your listeners will know who've been through this process, you get promoted to the point at which it doesn't have to have any more fun. So then you are all about the numbers. You're all about kind of, are you getting your invoices paid? You're about the tricky client relationship bit. You've essentially grown up.
Right.
And so as you reach adulthood in advertising, life just gets a lot tougher, actually, because your clients are all expecting you to know more than, yes, that ad's going to be ready on time. Yes, the recording studios, but for revising that voiceover, you move out of the easy stuff and in some ways out of the fun stuff. So I was at publicists quite a long time. And then I decided that advertising was brilliant, but actually I was ready to do more of the rest of it, more in the communication space, in the marketing space. So I moved to DWP, Department for Work and Pensions, the least popular department in government, which when I say I sort of peaked, I really did peak young, actually. So I went from being a really interesting dinner party guest when we were allowed to have dinner parties and people going, oh, what shoots have you been to? Oh, what clients are you working on? To, you do what now? For who? So not content with being in the least popular government departments, I moved from there to the Financial Conduct Authority, or the regulator, the Financial Services Authority, as it was
right.
then, which I can tell you now is sort of only one step up from a lawyer in a dinner party conversation. People just go, ooh, really? Regulation?
Oh, well, I tell you what, you haven't worked in new business. That is the ultimate turnoff in a dinner party conversation. People try and figure out what the hell that was all about. But
Do new business for all. It's hard work.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. But I mean, what inspired you to launch Predictive Black? And more to the point, where does that name come from?
Ah, okay. So the name is actually, it's really hard coming up with names, by the way. So anybody who's launched their own business, who's come up with a name, like you have with your business, Keith, I have a lot of admiration for, because it's a bit of a head scratcher. So we ended up keeping it simple. So in fintech, people invent words all the time, or add letters to existing words and go, that makes us cool. We didn't want to do that. Actually, so we wanted to be able to talk to finance directors and them not think we sounded like some weird kids that had just kind of landed from space. So we thought, well, what do we actually do? We do predictions. So we do predictions based off your financial data and we marry that to sector data. So predictive, that's what, nail our colors to the mast. And black, because businesses need to stay in the black. No business wants to go into the red. So it was a very simple kind of, predictive, yes, stay in the black, yes, predictive black, awesome. So that's kind of where
it was a mashup of two logical conclusions, basically, or two logical functions of the business, yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose that about now, under normal conditions, you would have been sort of doing the rounds of various conferences and seminars and stuff. I mean, how have you changed your business now to adapt to remote working? I mean, you said at the start, obviously, you were set up to do it. But I mean, have you had to alter many other things, like obviously person-to-person meetings, I guess?
I mean, Zoom, I put a post on LinkedIn a while ago about how things had changed post-lockdown. And prior to lockdown, everybody was okay doing phone calls. If you couldn't do a face-to-face meeting, a phone call was fine. Now, everybody does a Zoom or a Teams, and it's always on camera. So it is no good having a face made for radio some days. It doesn't work. just doesn't work. And I actually had loads of meetings the other day, and my kids had given me a cold, and I was like, oh my God, my face is literally made for radio. And I turned up on one meeting, I was like, this is it, I'm switching my camera off, goodbye.
Or you just have a mask up or something. Yeah,
I should have just a picture of myself and hope for the best. So, yeah, so there's a lot more video engagement, which actually I've kind of grown to quite enjoy. It's the next best thing. Right. So you can take your virtual cuppa, or some evenings it's been a glass of wine, and that's okay. If that's how we have to do it now, then that's right. Good.
And so, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? You kind of, we'll sort of get to a point where it becomes not normal, but it becomes a lot less uncomfortable. I mean, it is weird to suddenly have just suddenly handbrake turn into, you know, this kind of way of doing business. I mean, I think we all kind of forget that this was only 6 months ago that what we're doing right now was considered not normal, you know. So yeah, it's quite interesting. Now, I mean, the UK itself, I mean, you mentioned fintech there. The UK leads the world in kind of fintech innovation. Can you just give us, if it's possible, just a quick overview of a subject that your website talks about, which is open banking, and how is this going to help us all in a wider context?
So open banking came about because of a lack of competition in right. the market. So you go back to 2016 before, and the Competition and Markets Authority and previous organizations had all talked about needing to unlock certain industries, and banking was very much locked down. You know, it was an industry that your data went in, you never got any data out. So if old school banking is very one-sided, the bank has your data, you don't get any benefit from that. There right. is nothing, you can do nothing with your data, you can't even access it. Open banking was freeing that your data from its shackles, basically, and saying you as the owner of the data, so that's a massive transformation. The bank doesn't own your data, you do. You can now give consent to all these other businesses to use your data to benefit you. So instead of it being locked away in some vault and the bank's not doing anything with it, you know, they now have a legal obligation to connect with businesses when you consent. It can't happen without your consent.
Right.
It's a really safe infrastructure. I mean, it's a very secure system. So, but it's since it actually came about, the amount of creativity. So if you look, there's over 2 million users of open banking now. There's over 200 providers of open banking services registered on the open banking website. It's insane the amount of creativity that's out there. I mean, it's amazing, actually.
Wow. What kind of impact does that have on the world of, say, marketing or branding and stuff like that? I mean, is there a knock-on effect in that way?
I think there is. I mean, just think of all the clients who didn't exist before that do now. So if you think about, you know, the Buds or these different apps, and you look on the open banking websites, and they are businesses who are in need of branding, communication, marketing. They're just a different niche. And so there's a whole sector that's opened up for really good marketeers to go after, I think. But they've still got some of the traditional problems. You know, they need to acquire clients, they need to brand themselves, they need to differentiate, they need to have some long-term value, they need to get investors on board. So, you know, the problems of the old school clients, they're the same that these new kids have got, but there's just a whole bunch more of them.
Wow. Well, that's fantastic. I mean, we'll come onto it sort of in a little bit, but there is a lot of conversation around the idea that while everything seems to have stopped or sort of slowed down, there are other parts of the market that are really kind of thriving at the moment. And I think you've probably just touched on one of them. And I mean, as a business, you tend to, I mean, looking through the way that you position the, you know, Predictive Black and the sort of the events that you were attending, you seem to be keen to kind of target the startup market. I mean, what is it about startups that make them an attractive target for Predictive Black?
So it's interesting. So I talk to startups a lot because we are still a startup. So I feel we have a duty of care to one another. We try and use each other's services, because if startups don't support each other, then frankly, who's going to support the rest of us? So I think there is almost an obligation to go and find those businesses that you can use and that you can contribute to their success. And, you know, hopefully that, you know, ecosystem mindset works.
Right.
Generally speaking as well, startups are more open-minded about how technology can, certainly the ones I engage with, and I appreciate I might be in my own little techie bubble, which is a novel place to be. But definitely the firms I engage with are really open-minded about how technology can transform and enable them to do things that they previously couldn't do, or they would have needed four people to do and they can't afford that. So
right. The
technological enablement is pretty much what makes a lot of the, particularly the startups I talk to, really attractive. And then you take that mindset and you think, okay, well, but there are a lot of people out there who have got that entrepreneurial mindset in bigger companies. You just have to go find them. And quite often they'll come and find you as well.
And are they all kind of young or sort of run by young people, or, you know, do you think there is innovation throughout? It's just, I was reading I read a report earlier today from Spotify about the youth market and how it's turning away from the sort of the institutional education upbringing because of the costs of education in there, and sort of looking at the fact that they now feel that they can pretty much start a business if they wanted to. There's the technology there. So, I mean, do you think this is driven by the youth, or do you reckon that there's hope for people of my age, you know, to be able to to kind of leverage some of this as well?
I'm certainly not a youth, so I'm on at least my third or fourth career already. So, and my fellow founders aren't youths either, but you have to have an open-mindedness, I think. So I don't think age is any barrier. You could start, for me, as long as you've got the idea and you have got the determination, you could start a business whenever you wanted to. I think the younger you are, the harder it is to get a regular job. And so starting a business actually becomes a default position rather than something you feel passionately about. I think the older you get and the more life experience you have, to start a business is a really bold thing to do because you know it's really tough. Whereas when you're younger, you haven't learned that yet. So, you know, I love meeting young startup people. I really enjoy it because their fabulous optimism is still intact and they haven't had life's rough edges.
They haven't been crushed.
They haven't been crushed yet. And I don't see it as my job to crush them. You know, it's definitely not for me to do. And it's great that there's more and more businesses out there. I mean, what's fascinating, even now, even during the pandemic, businesses are still starting. You know, right. And actually, that's fabulous. You know, if you look at the data, I mean, obviously we look at data. So I look at data all the time from the Office for National Statistics and Companies House, and businesses are still starting. Yes, businesses are closing. More businesses will close before the end of this year when all the government schemes run out. But there are still people thinking, you know what, I'm going to go for this. I'm going to start a business. And that is an immense amount of hope, actually, for our economy.
That's good news. That's nice to hear. And I mean, talking of which, I mean, obviously, you talk a slightly different language from the sort of the sort of general sort of economic or financial sort of communication side of things. Your service kind of relies on artificial intelligence and machine learning to sort of pull in financial information. But, you know, as we know, humans aren't always, you know, pretty good at interpreting data. I mean, but the data on, you know, certainly on your site and the data that I've seen coming from Predictive Black seems very, very user-friendly. I mean, you know, did you kind of factor that into it when you were sort of looking at the presentation of the data, is to sort of simplify it in some way?
Yeah, absolutely. Who wants to be bored to death with a bunch of numbers? I mean, God, you know, life is too short, frankly. And also, what do you do with them when you've got them? You know, anybody can download a data dump and put it in a CSV file and you end up with possibly an Excel spreadsheet that's impenetrable. Nobody can be bothered. I mean, I'm sure there are, one of my co-founders, Chris, he could definitely do that and he'll chew through all that data and enjoy himself. He is not normal.
I'm sure he'll love to hear that.
He's lucky, but he's not normal, you know, bless his heart. And one of the things that you need to then be able to do is translate data into something that is useful. And right. A picture tells 1,000 words, you know, and that's an old adage, but it rings true. So how do you convert some hard economic data into a user-friendly visualization? And for us, we experimented, right? We've had gauges, we've had line charts, we've had everything.
Right.
But we have, at the moment, we simplify it down into four things. We have an outlook for every sector. So that's based on the revenue for that sector, and then our prediction for what will happen next, which is a bold thing to do.
Right.
Based on, you know, all the data we take in. We then have six charts that form the basis of our revenue forecast for that sector. Then we look at costs, and then crucially, we look at cash. So the metrics that tend to matter most to businesses are their revenue, their costs, and their cash. Everything fits neatly into those buckets. So if you pull your data in and frame it in that way, then what we do is we say, okay, so what are the big indicators around, let's say, costs? Well, number of people you employ. And how many employees per revenue band? Well, that's a really interesting piece of data.
Right.
So if I'm a new business now, or marketing, or if I'm one of your regular listeners, I would be looking at the data and saying, does this data validate the sectors I want to target, where I think I can win? You know, am I able to convert that data into something that I can go to my CEO or my chairman and go, this sector is where I want to pitch and play, and these are the reasons why, and it's growing, and the business numbers are growing, turnover's increasing, costs are decreasing, whatever the measures are you want to look at. You know, that for me is where the data turns into something, from something dry into something super desirable.
Well, I think we'll leave it there. We'll just put your phone number on the bottom. That's it. Well done. Excellent. You just saved yourself about 30 minutes there. But I mean, one thing that that people working in new business are all aware of is the that dreaded sales funnel, which gradually allows a salesperson to kind of hone in on the right prospect with the right message. I mean, how does Predictive Black help an agency understand more about their prospective markets in that respect?
So if you're a specialist agency, then you've got it easy, right? So if you're talking about pharma and you're only targeting pharma, your life is, I'm not going to say it's easy, but it's a bit more focused, because there are a certain number of firms, there's a certain number of people you can go for. If you're a more generalist agency, that first moment of truth where you have to say, who am I going to target? And it's either because they've got a new CMO and they've learned that through your service and they're kind of going, oh, right, crikey, what do I know about this person? You're already too late at that point. Right? You're probably missing the boat anyway, because you didn't know the CMO before they went there. So I would use the data. My old self would use this data in a far more strategic way.
Right.
In my quarterly business review meetings with my old boss, I would be sitting with this data and saying, here are the sectors that are growing. Here, and the reason why they're growing is there's more businesses in that sector, or the revenue is increasing, or, you know, all the different variables you can put into play. And I think there are some really interesting firms in that sector, and here you can drill down into the firms. And then when you get into that, you can say, okay, do I have a right to win with any of these people? What expertise can we bring? So instead of going in with a kind of, you know, dart thrown at a dartboard, use the data to drive the breadth of your, when they're still suspects, right? They're not actually prospects yet. They're suspects in your funnel. Use the data to say, are we looking at the right place? You know, just because we like construction, are we going to win a house building clients or not? You know, and what's happening in construction? Are we ever going to win there? You know, maybe, maybe not. So use the data to inform the picture and really to give you some hard numbers. I mean, people find hard numbers intimidating, and yet they love them. So extract the hard numbers.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's become increasing. I think that, you know, there was a time not so long ago when the new business role was very kind of instinctive, and there was a lot more kind of sort of gut feel sort of running things. But I think now, because people have to make a very insightful approach to people, you can't just scattergun everything. You've got to be kind of, you know, more direct with people, that I think having the actual numbers there to back up with what you were talking about makes all the difference.
Now, go back to your point at the start, Keith, you said about empathy. So
yeah,
clients are just regular people, newsflash, you know, having been on both sides, I can confirm that clients are mostly regular people as well. And if you evidence effort, that you have spent effort, this is not just a bog standard cold call email or a bog standard leaflet or hey, here's a summary of the work I did recently that is of no relevance to you whatsoever. You know, no client gives a monkey's about that. Your showreel, if it's irrelevant, is irrelevant. You know, that's just a fact. So if you can use a little bit of effort to go through some data to emphasize the empathy, and I think that's a really great word, not often used, and I think it's a really good word for this instance, to empathize with the client, to say, I understand the challenges happening in your sector right now. I don't know that they're happening in your business absolutely, although you might be able to dig more deeper into that anyway, but in your sector, you know, things are happening, costs are increasing, sure. You know, you're affected by FX prices or fuel prices or whatever, or, you know, overdraft lending has hit you hard because you're a small regional building society, I don't know. So show that you've put some effort in, and I think the doors open slightly more ajar for you if you do it well.
I think that's a great thing. And I mean, you know, I used the word empathy, you know, very deliberately before, because it's not a question of being a shoulder to cry on or to say, I understand. It's more a question of knowing what it is you're talking about, so that people know that they're not going to be wasting the next 15, 20 minutes in a conversation with you, having to explain stuff that they do, you know, regularly. If you can come preloaded with that data and with that information, then you're already sort of halfway through the, you know, through the process there.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes data just gives you an angle where you can say, is this your experience?
So yes, actually
we're trying to use the data, we're trying to get, you know, more of a handle on your sector. Is it your experience that costs are increasing to this percentage that we're seeing in the analysis that we have access to? You know, and is that your way in? You know, wouldn't that be a great one to have? And maybe the marketing director goes, yeah, actually, that's it. Or crikey, I don't know. I'd love to know what you're looking at.
Sold. Fantastic. Well, let's talk K-shaped recoveries. Because we've been talking recently about, you know, about looking at markets and sectors that are bouncing back. And, you know, obviously there are things that aren't, that have stagnated, and there are other things that as we said earlier, that have, you know, that are booming or coming back. I mean, this is really playing into Predicted Black's kind of strengths now, isn't it? And in terms of being able to monitor very quickly what's going up and what's going down. I mean, is it possible to kind of just give us a quick top line on, you know, sort of what you see in terms of markets and where the sort of the good news is?
So you've got all the usual suspects, right? Usual suspects. How random is that? 6 months down the line. Anyway, but you've got the ones that we all know. So anything that is in the badging of remote enablement, which is a collective term for products like Zoom or the Teams from Microsoft, or anything that enables you to work remotely. So things like technical hardware, not the sexiest of sectors, technical hardware has gone through the roof. You cannot get a deal on a decent laptop for love nor money.
Or cameras and things like that.
Or cameras or microphones, or, you know, if you want to have one of those things that raises your desk up and down, anything that is in that category of remote enablement is absolutely going like a train. And there are new things coming out all the time, which is really exciting. So that's going really well. Interestingly, parts of retail, which is you would expect, are going really well. So the last recession, all the big four supermarkets tanked. The discounters just ripped them to bits. This time around, actually, the big four have done rather well, and you'll see that in their numbers. And the discounters have also done okay. Right. So they are opening new stores. BMM Retail this week announced they're opening 45.
I saw your post about that. I thought that was very interesting. Yeah, because so, you've got a classic discount retailer that's really kind of like grabbed it and gone with
it. Absolutely. And I think what will be fascinating is the customer behavior shift. And your listeners will be more into this space than I am currently. But is that a permanent shift? You know, will people, having switched from a big store, will they actually carry on shopping at the smaller B&M retailers? Some parts of local shopping have done really well. So if you listen to the news, the high street is dead. If you go out into your local high street, guarantee you don't think it's dead. No. You're actually thinking there's lots of small independent retailers that have opened, pushing the boom up in new businesses starting as well, actually, which is interesting. from the people that you talk to regularly, Keith, the marketers and the communicators, actually that's not terribly good news. Lots of tiny independent businesses don't make big clients.
Right.
So you have to really look at the structure of how the economy starts to reshape itself. And I think that's where it's interesting to look at the data patterns, and it's interesting to understand the trends. You know, then you've got the other things, you know, which is still technically in the remote space, the Netflix, you know, it doubled its subscription.
Man, tell me about it. Yeah.
Just crazy. That's not going to change anytime soon. You've got weird things that have done really well. Health products. Now that is, you know, there's a big, big market for online beauty that has done really well. A lot of online has done really well. Unsurprisingly, delivery drivers, they're doing very well, you know, anything like that. But then you've also got the kind of, if I think about old school businesses, and Microsoft is a brilliant example of this, they are super nimble, actually.
Right.
So even though they're a behemoth in the world of computer software and hardware and stuff, they are unbelievably smart at switching things on and off. Teams, all schools are using Teams, pretty much all the ones I know anyway. You know, they got in there and they really landed that market. So I think there's a lot of positivity, shall we say, but there will be a lot of businesses that do go to the wall this side of Christmas. It's inevitable.
Right. But it's going to be, I mean, this basically, I mean, does sell your case for you a great deal, because, you know, it's basically saying that you can't actually predict too far into the future how things are going to be. So you need to be nimble. You need to be able to kind of, you know, to switch things on and off depending on how the markets are changing. So, you know, I think it's, you know, this just strengthens your case in terms of, you know, supplying good quality information, you know, when people need it, rather than retrospective stuff that you can no longer rely on. So
now I think almost, you know, I was an account director for quite a long time. You know, I would have loved something like this, because it means I wouldn't have been reliant on just, you know, what my insight manager, and we were very lucky at Publicis, we had a great little insight team.
Sure.
They were overwhelmed, you know, so if you can be responsible for your own insight into your businesses and actually break out of the Marcom's bubble, you know, not everything that's reported in Marketing Week or Campaign or those guys is the only thing news that you should have at your fingertips. You know, you should really have a breadth of data at your fingertips.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Absolutely. Absolutely true. Now, I got to say, I'm a bit of a kind of a data geek myself. And when I first saw what you guys do and how kind of smart it is, I was really impressed. And I know that we're currently a few weeks away from anything official, but there will be soon a pretty exciting development for agencies that use the services of the show sponsor, The Advertist. And I'm hoping to persuade you to provide us with a regular update of market insight, because I think this is really genuinely useful stuff, and I'd hate for it to be a one-off. So it'd be great if you could come back and sort of fill us in with more information as we go through. Because I it's just that I think Predictive Black is going to be a very valuable tool for new business prospecting. You know, it's no longer a case of, you know, in sales being all things to all men and trying to play the numbers game. You need to be able to focus in on the few kind of most likely prospects that you're going to work with. And I, you know, personally, I think this service is exactly the right tool to do it with. So, you know, I'm very keen that we let as many people know about this as possible. So what advantage can artificial intelligence bring to big data to help the agency sector? What is the kind of the USP there?
That is such a brilliant question. So
thank you.
I think you've obviously done this before.
One of shows not too bad going for me.
So I think where artificial intelligence, so it all stems from machine learning, and, you know, there's been a lot of good stuff written and a lot of bad stuff written,
right,
about, you know, robots are going to take over, all that kind of stuff. Well, no, not necessarily. Certain things robots will be able to do. Car manufacturing, that's brilliant. You know, 3D printers, that's awesome. So there's a lot of stuff technology can do.
Right.
I think where it can really help in this space in particular is that it enables you to process vast amounts of data incredibly quickly. You know, so that what we do with the algorithms we do and the machine learning logic we run across our data, it would take months. You know, if go back a few years, we couldn't do what we do. This just wouldn't exist. So I think the enablement of that, and actually open banking, going back to open banking, is one of those crucial enablers of our ability. So when I marry up the open banking access with the machine learning power and capability, suddenly you've got businesses like mine springing up, which nobody had thought of a few years ago. Sure. So, I mean, I would encourage people to embrace the possibilities of it. You know, yes, keep maybe a slightly cynical eye on, well, what will it do for me? But really keep an open mind about how it can be used to your advantage, because there's a lot of positive advantages out there for using AI.
Wow. Well, it's really just about, I mean, you said right at the opening, it just increases the speed of decision making. And I mean, in the new business world, if we're talking about being useful to prospects, then being there at a point of need when it's useful is exactly what we need to be doing. So definitely speed of decision making helps you sort of become more nimble and react more quickly. So it's not just about new business. I mean, I want to make sure that obviously we cover this, because that's just one facet of what you do, isn't it? I mean, how does Predictive Black kind of benefit a company right across the board? I mean, what other areas do you impact?
So we obviously, our industry analysis, which is predicated on a company's, now this is the technical bit, standard industry classification code.
Yes.
Their SIC code or NACE code, depending on where you're at, which is from the Office for National Statistics. And all registered companies have a number, and that number equates to the code that they're in. So we pull that data through.
Right.
So we have that as a product, which, you know, we've talked about. We then use that for our clients who want our financial forecasting software. And we take their sector data and we marry it to their financial data and their accounting data. And we say, right, this is what your predictive cash flow forecast looks like for the next 3 months, 6 months, however long we can work it out through. And the reason why that's different and kind of interesting is it's not based on a traditional plus or minus 5%, or, you know, the owner of the business putting their finger in the wind and going, I think I'll do well this year, I'll add 10% onto my forecast, or not going so well, I'm going to lop off 20%. It is actually based on sector performance as well.
Right.
So, you know, if you're an ad agency or a marcoms agency, you might say to me, well, my competition is not other ad agencies, actually. I'm not competing with those. You really are, because you're not pitching against anyone else. But, you know, I have had agencies say to me, no, that's I'm definitely not in competition with those people. Unfortunately, you really are. So, you know, if how are you performing against your sector? So we would show you and benchmark you to your sector. So your peers may be doing incredibly well and you may not. You may be behind the ball, eight ball.
Right.
Or you might be pushing 10% ahead already. And so in which case, can you really say that's going to carry on for the following 12 months? You know, do you really think that's possible? You might have just had a really good bump in the previous year. So the machine nets off all of those different factors and it learns, right? Machine learning. So it doesn't know in advance if you're going to cut 25% of your headcount. It can only know when you tell it. So it's as good as that old garbage in, garbage out. It's as good as the information right. You give it. So for us, it's super exciting because as the machine gets more information from a company, from a client, it gets better.
Wow.
And that's just so exciting.
And so, the point is that this kind of touches so many different points in any business. I mean, you know, not from obviously from sales through to, you know, the forecasting side of it through to HR, you know, all those different. I mean, the point basically is that, you know, sort of any company that engages with you obviously has access to this, and that information can impact lots of different, it adds value to lots of different parts of the business rather than just as a new business thing, as a new business tool, or, you know, whatever. It can actually, you know, sort of augment other parts of the business as well.
Yeah, totally. And talking to, you know, different types of businesses who may use it as client relationship management, you know, particularly in financial services, you know, if they're given, if they're created as a user and they can get access, then you can use it as a way of saying, yes, I can help this client more in this space, or, you know, they're going to need more money down the line and here's what we can do. So yeah, there's all sorts of different ways of using it. But, you know, I can envisage the situation where a finance person is sat with an HR person, is sat with the sales director, and they're saying, okay, if we need to make, you know, and that, and you know, in the old days, people used to sit together. I don't know if you remember those days.
Yes, the old boardroom table. Yeah.
And they'd sit together, and the finance director say, right, well, we can't afford your X new headcount sales director. So the HR director is going to have to cut a few people. And very quickly, with our scenario tool, is you can say, okay, well, how much extra revenue would I need? I need plus 5%. And that's not going to cover your payroll. HR woman says, or man says, you're going to need £15,000 extra a month. So you type that in, and that's a cost. And then the sales guy goes, well, in that case, I'm going to need to make 50 grand to cover everything. And the finance director plugs that in, and you can play. You just play in real time and create these scenarios, and you'll know, you know, can you afford what you think you need, or are you going to need some money? Are you going to need to cut heads? Are you going to need to cut back on your supplier bills? You know, all of these things you will be able to figure out very quickly.
So, I mean, it is a Swiss Army knife for, you know, for a business, which is, you know, that's...
Now, if I was still in advertising, I'd be sending out Swiss Army knives to people, wouldn't I?
Ah, yeah, well, there you go. Well, there's still an opportunity. Mind you, I'm not sure sending knives to people is a good idea at the moment.
I don't think it's allowed.
But I mean, I was reading through your and anybody that listening to this, you need to go and have a look at the Predictive Black website, because it is so uncomplicated in terms of its presentation of information that even a dummy like me can read through it. And I found it really informative, and I ended up going down a rabbit hole in terms of talking about the kind of big data and data tech and how it impacts the world of marketing and advertising too. And that kept coming across the Open Communications Initiative. And I was wondering if you could just briefly kind of go through what that is and how that could possibly affect where we are in the sort of marketing communications side of things.
No, I'd encourage anyone who hasn't, and I know this is really nerdy, but remember, I worked in government and regulation for a while, so you just have to let me have it, you know. But go and have a look at the Open Data Institute. They're a really good source for this. So the government has a data strategy, not yet updated and published, and they want to learn from the success of open banking and see which other industries would be ripe to be opened in the same way that banking has been opened. And communications is high on their list. So right. Ofcom is responsible for it, and they are consulting currently as to how they might do it. And essentially what they're trying to do is say, how can we replicate the success of open banking by opening up your data? So similar way, I would own my mobile data, I would own my any data connected to communications, my broadband data, you know, whatever that is, it's mine. Yeah. And therefore I can then enable that and hook up to different applications who don't probably exist right now, you know, in the same way that in the open banking space, none of us existed. So who knows what will come, but what an exciting time. I mean, I think if I look back at the Open Banking Initiative, and if I could have envisaged then how successful it's been, you know, 2 million users in a short space of time is phenomenal, and it will just keep growing. So yes, open communications will be your version of what we've experienced in the financial services industry.
Wow. Okay. Well, there we go. There's a bit of homework for everybody. So have a look at that. And
respond to the consultation. I think actually, you know what? I think Marcom's agencies, ad agencies, would be super, super well primed to go and respond. And the amount of creativity inside those organizations, if you guys can't come up with the best app or the best way of using data, then frankly, nobody can. And if you let the banking boys beat you, then I'm sad.
Oh man, we can't have that. We can't have the accountancy firms doing it either. But so, I mean, you're quite open about it. You're a new breed of company. And we on the podcast and with the Advertist, we've been examining the kind of the advantages of agile businesses and sort of when something like a pandemic happens, you know, the benefits of being agile. Obviously, you couldn't have predicted a pandemic was coming, but, well, I don't know, did you?
Well, back in November, actually, we did start having a conversation about the data coming out of Wuhan. So, Chris, who is our, who is responsible for the product and is the kind of crazy guy, I remember vividly a conversation where he said, "Oh, I don't like the sound of this virus. I think we should start tracking. Is there a way?"
Wow.
I know. If I could bottle him, I would. I hope he doesn't listen, because I don't want him to get all big-headed.
He is a genius. I have spoken to him briefly, and I know he is at least part genius.
I know. Don't tell him that, though. I don't want him to get all big-headed on me. Of course, nobody predicted it. But actually, I think there was enough noise, actually, which I think will definitely inform the world's response to the next one, which won't be far
right.
away. You know, once they hit. And I think we didn't respond when it was all Asia-based, right? We didn't respond to avian flu. We didn't respond to all of those different variants. But we will respond now. You know, now it's affected us. And I think that way, it's an unfortunate lesson to learn.
You could probably now, I mean, obviously with artificial intelligence and machine learning, you can now spot patterns that are starting to develop and sort of, you know, at least it can flag up something similar to what happened before is starting to happen again, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. We got a grant from Innovate, the UK R&D that kind of funds everything. And so we applied for a COVID-related grant to do a COVID financial index. And so on our website now, you can actually see we've got it for all countries, and there's a lot of amazing data out there, and universities routinely are fabulous for putting stuff out there for you to go look at. But we looked at the stringency index, you know, how well or not did a country respond? And I think that actually the basis for that analysis will form future predictions. So we use some of that in our Outlook data already. And I think that will definitely inform the confidence level, at least. So I would imagine the OECD are looking at this as well. But definitely confidence in the economy for these different countries. You know, I would think predictions will be far tighter next time round.
Wow. This is so impressive. It's great to, you know, to hear that, you know, that this isn't the sort of just the domain of, you know, the big sort of data companies. And it's really good to see that that Predictive Black is kind of you know, sort of punching well above its weight here. And I mean, but most of the anything that would be considered a competitor to you, I mean, these are large scale monolithic businesses. I mean, Predictive Black obviously has an advantage in its agility. I mean, has that played to your strengths, do you think?
I think it both plays to your strengths and causes you a weakness as well, doesn't it? Because the big players are ensconced. And, you know, if you're used to paying a gazillion pounds for an enterprise software or, you know, reports that take 3 years to get published and are out of date, you know, if that's what you're used to, and if you're a massive global organization and that's where you're at, then really little fish like us, you know, we're not terribly exciting to them yet. And I think part of my job as the CEO is to get on their radar and make ourselves exciting, and to show them that there is a different way, that data doesn't have to be consumed in the way they do it, and that frankly we can do a lot with the data they have that they're probably, even the big boys, probably aren't using in the way we would yet. So, you know, I think you have to have ambition. You have to think, just because they're big now, they weren't always big.
They started from somewhere. They absolutely did. You know, it's like I said before, it was, you know, sort of the new business relationship is all about, you know, being valuable. And that was how they became so big in the first place, was because they were able to do that. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, history can repeat itself quite effectively. But we had a chat a while back with an applied futurist, a guy called Tom Cheesewright.
I listened to that one.
Okay. So, I mean, you realize, I mean, his book, Future Proofing Your Business, mm-hmm. and how agility is kind of, you know, should be kind of baked into a business model. Part of it, I thought I'd sort of reflect back to you now, because I reread it last night, and I was thinking about the piece that actually talks about the way that different departments within a company, and this comes back on what we were just talking about, on different departments and how they access data, and the fact that it's a good thing, it's healthy for a business to actually have different departments accessing data and interpreting it from their kind of perspectives to give it an expert sort of eye. I mean, do you believe in the democratization of data within a business? And I mean, okay, so I mean, what are the advantages of that?
So I think we all get locked into our own little way of thinking. And even if you consider yourself to have an open mindset, your learned behavioural responses are going to be framed by what you do on a day-to-day basis. So I may look at a piece of data and say, ah, that's fascinating. I can see that electronic bicycles are really doing really well. You may look at it and go, oh my God, that's so tiny, it's pointless. You know, right. I don't even want to think about that. Well, I'm not going to bother with them. And someone else might look at it and go, well, I've never liked cycling. We all bring our bias, right? So bias is there. And I think one of the ways that democratizing data helps an organization is it removes some of your own bias. And we are not good enough as humans to recognize our own bias, even if we think we've nailed kind of what we do and don't like. We're not. We bring it to the table every single day. And data, looking at data and understanding data, everybody brings a different lens. And that is so important because you avoid this horrible groupthink and you avoid missing something that could be magical. So if you lock data in, you know, like the banking sector did all those years ago and don't let anybody at it, then it just is, it's just a pointless set of numbers. You know, what is it doing for you? If you don't release it and let it have its moment of magic and let people, really clever, creative people, who wouldn't ordinarily necessarily get access to it, have a think about it, they will come up with some really good stuff.
It's an amazing thing because it's one of the weaknesses that we, if you look back on, you know, monolithic businesses, was that the people at the top of a business were the decision makers, and very much the business was a manifestation of their kind of way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And you know, nowadays, when you've got, you know, companies like Google or Facebook or whatever that have that kind of multi-headed sort of decision-making process, which I think, you know, it does help a business kind of shape itself and mold itself around to be able to absorb big impact events like we've just had. So, you know, I think it's always a good thing to do. So, and again, this is where you come in, you know, because obviously your data can be interpreted by several different departments in, you know, sort of in one go.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we don't always talk to the sexy departments. So, you know, I might be talking to corporate treasurers and then talking to financial planners and analysts. So,
hey, they're sexy too.
They like to think so, and I'm very supportive of that.
That's fine. So, okay, so big picture now. I mean, what's coming up in the next few months for Predictive Black? I mean, can you predict that?
So a lot more hard work because everybody has to work really hard. We are onboarding more and more clients. We have a little moment where we just have to kind of pinch ourselves and go, is our onboarding process the best? You know, always ask yourself the question. So I think we spend a lot of time asking ourselves the question, have we got this right? Is that going well? Listening to our clients. So I want to onboard a bunch more clients. We're looking at new markets because you start looking at new markets, you know, that's all good. Mm-hmm. And my CFO is based in the US.
Is the data market different in the US?
No, they literally took the data structure from the UK and implemented it in a very similar way. So they have NACE. So it's very similar, actually. And the only place where it differs is where you get into the state by state and kind of what gets published. They don't have open banking in the same way. It's fascinating.
No.
Most of the major banks do APIs and hook up your data and stuff. So they're not regulated. They're not forced to do it, but they're mostly the big ones are doing it.
Yeah. Well, that's good news. That's interesting. Okay. So
I'd love to get a bunch of your listeners on board as clients.
Well,
we will
try our best. We'll definitely, I mean, one of the things we're going to do is, you know, obviously we're going to make sure that we stay in contact, regular contact with you, and that we sort of feature some of the highlights of your reporting in what we do. So there's obviously going to be a lot of crossover there, and we'll keep mentioning it, and it'd be great to keep having you back on the show, you know, on the Fuel, just to give us a quick update on how things are going. Because I think a good, you know, a nice little temperature check every, you know, every month or so would be very useful for the listeners as well. So
if there's sectors that your listeners are super interested in, then let me know and I can make sure we cover those as well. Because otherwise you'll get the stuff I'm interested in. and I'll bring my own bias to all that.
We'll have all your contact information on the show notes anyway. But we will definitely make sure that we keep feeding the loop there, the information loop. We've talked about the business and how hard working you are. I mean, when you're not working so hard, I mean, how do you get to relax? What does Zita do to relax these days?
I've got kids, a husband and dogs. There is no space. Yeah, right. I mean, literally I've decided I need a wife. Someone's coming. any offers, I'd be gladly take them up. Someone who's kind of happy to come and look after me would be awesome. What do we do? So I used to think I was really good at board games. I've realised in these months where we've all been together a lot more, I am rubbish at board games.
And what's your favourite board game?
Well, I've decided now I'm not into anything clever or smart. I'm only going to play frustration because the popper is a really, really satisfying game. I still lose.
It's amazing how much punishment that can take as well, isn't it?
I know, right? Until it flies off. But my kids invented their own version of Monopoly for 2020. And so they have their own board that they put together. And they have cities like Wuhan. And they've got things that went well, you know, things that were topical like Black Lives Matter. You can buy a seat at a table for the UN, and their chance cards are really vicious.
Wow. Actually.
Yeah.
They've done this themselves.
They came up with it themselves. Took them weeks. And
I see a phone call to Hasbro in your future.
I know, right? My husband said the same. So we play that actually, and I never win that either, you know. And I'm thinking, at some point, I should just concede defeat, and I should just, you know, pick up my book or do a bit of yoga or play with the dogs and just let the kids win because they're going to win anyway.
That's it. Well, that's relaxing as well, as to have them off your back as well, I guess, at some stage. But I did pre-warn you about this, and we are putting together a second edition of the Fuel Podcast mixtape. I kind of asked you to put in a track, and I'm fascinated by this one. So what track are you going to put in?
So the Manic Street Preachers' Motorcycle Emptiness from their debut album Generation Terrorists, which is still one of my all-time favourite albums. And I actually have the vinyl still in its sealed wrapper.
Wow.
That my then boyfriend bought me at a gig of theirs we went to in 1992.
Well, you know, that's fascinating. I mean, because obviously Manic Street Preachers, I mean, you're talking about the edition with Richie Edwards in it, and you know, the original lineup of the band, and because you sent that to me, I thought, well, I'll give it another listen, and it's amazing how fresh that sounds. I mean, I wasn't a big fan of them, but they do sound they have stood the test of time,
and then into Little Baby Nothing and all that. It's just fabulous. It's just a fabulous album.
It's a very good track, and I think it's good. And it joins, actually, I did a show yesterday, and it's amazing. I got a double header of intellectual rock bands, because yesterday's choice was Pulp, which was excellent. So now I've got two intellectual rock bands in there, but definitely Manic Street Preachers and definitely Motorcycle Emptiness. So that's fantastic. So good call anyway. Yeah. Do you still follow them, just out of interest?
I do. I listen to all their stuff. James Dean Bradfield put out
He's got a solo album, hasn't he?
But I always go back to the old stuff. There's a lot of great Welsh bands anyway. So I listen to Catfish and the Bottlemen a lot as well, who are a younger Welsh band. They're awesome. So
is there a Welsh connection then?
I am Welsh for my sins.
Right. Okay, I did wonder. I did wonder, but so that's whereabouts from?
From the north, the only part of Wales. Sorry to anyone from the south, but the only part of Wales.
Okay, so talking of Welsh, the book recommendation has a touch of Celtic to it as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. does, it does. So the book thing really challenged me. I was almost going to have to withdraw because the stress level through the roof. It's like, how do I choose the book? So I talked over with my son, is a proper bookworm. He reads everything. And we debated at length. And we agreed that the book that we both love and we read it pretty much every year is a book called The Dark is Rising by Susan Cooper, which is a teen young adult book. And it has overtones of the Arthurian legend. It has a lot of Welsh folklore. I read the Mabinogion when I was growing up, which is Welsh folk tales. So it is a really fascinating little piece of literature that is very challenging as well, because it's about the old folk and the magic. And if you love that sort of thing, a bit of fantasy and a bit of magic, it's perfect.
I think, I could go for that. I think I'll have to check that one out. I'm not familiar with it.
Start reading it. It starts, the book The Dark is Rising is the second in the series, but it starts on the 20th of December. So there's a massive Twitter following for this book. So
really?
Hashtag The Dark is Rising, you will find a global community of people who read it every year, and they are in it from the start.
And so what, it starts at a certain time of year, is that the whole
point? Yeah, it starts, and then so the young protagonist, it starts on the 20th of December, and then he wakes on the 21st of December, and his world has changed completely.
Wow. Okay, well, that's cool. There we go. I've got something to do over Christmas now. That's fantastic. Zita, listen, thank you so much. This has been fantastic. And as I say, this isn't going to be farewell. It's just see you later, and we'll catch up with you soon, because I'm very keen that we keep in touch with you, and we keep building your wonderful kind of data into what we're doing, and we keep talking about it. But thank you so much. I appreciate you putting time aside, especially as it's the end of the week, and I know you've had a tough week, so it's been
busy.
Very good of you.
So still good busy.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and we'll check in with you in a few weeks' time, and hopefully see you soon. In the meantime, take care. Look after yourself.
And you. Thank you.
Just wow. Now, I'm not what you'd call a detail person, but even I can see how useful predictive Black's data is going to be to the new business process. It's hard not to make this sound like a big commercial, but if your agency is looking for a rich picture of new sectors and industries, then this is the future, my friend. You'll be hearing more from Zita over the next few weeks and months, as she's going to become a regular contributor to the show, which in the end is going to help you do your job. And that's exactly why we launched this podcast in the first place. Thank you for all the positive feedback we've been getting. If you want to write to us, drop us a line via the website at www.thefuelpodcast.com. We read every email, and we promise to get back to you. My thanks also to my co-producer Donna, our in-house band, The Prospectors, that's St. Matthew, Barney and Memory Banks, all IT functionality provided by the team at Quijibo Design in downtown Indianapolis. So join us next time on The Fuel, the new business podcast sponsored by The Advertist, the new business development platform, when we'll be serving up another nourishing gourmet course of sales wisdom, as well as a healthy dose of insight for the new business curious. And really, shouldn't that include you?